thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 23 for the 19th of March, 2008. Happy birthday! I'm Dan Cohen. And it's the first anniversary celebratory edition of Digital Campus here at the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. I'm Dan Cohen, always found at dancohen.org and elsewhere. And as usual, with me are the other two hosts of the show, Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Dan.
And Mills Kelly from edwired.org. Hi, Mills.
Hi, Dan.
Hey, congratulations, guys. We've made it a year in podcasting.
Wow.
And, yeah, amazing to think. You know, we're going to have for our feature coming up, our feature segment in the middle of the program. We'll be discussing what we've learned over the past years and some of the things that we've, I think, done right and done wrong and could improve on, and maybe ask from some help from our audience to fine-tune the show into our second year. So that'll be coming up in about 15 to 20 minutes. But as usual, we like to start with the news roundup. And it was a juicy week, or a few weeks of news. We're a week late on this podcast because we had spring break last week. I guess an appropriate topic then, since what was on the minds of everyone on campus was Juicy, the launch of JuicyCampus.com, a new wiki site where students, faculty, and others can post anonymous things about other people. Tom, you've been tracking this story for us from the CH&M newsroom. Can you tell us a little bit more about this site and sort of what's going on there and your initial thoughts about it?
Well, I should say to begin that I haven't been tracking it too closely because I think if you go to this site, you will probably be almost immediately offended. Essentially, it's a place to post campus gossip, and it is, as the header says, totally 100% anonymous. So essentially, it's a place where I think it's mostly students. I don't know how many professors are actually using this, but mostly students can go and post rumors about their classmates. And it is it turns out to be an incredibly offensive thing. There's a lot of rumors about, you know, different students' sexual behaviors. There's a lot of stuff about, you know, who's the richest kid on campus, those kinds of things. And then there's some fairly sinister stuff, calling people out for various things that they've done, and actually posting things like, who are all the Jews on campus, and trying to compile lists of certain ethnic and racial minorities on campus. So right now it's only open to a select few campuses. I guess gratefully, George Mason, I don't think, is one of them yet. But it's rolling out, and it seems really popular. I mean, I just logged onto the site in preparation for the podcast, and it took forever to load, so it must be getting lots of use. But really pretty scary.
Yeah, I'm having trouble loading it too. Mills, what are your thoughts about the impact of this site if it really catches on campus?
I have to say, I don't think it's going to catch on for long. I think it'll be sort of one of those hype bubbles where lots of people will go and check it out, but it has no other use value other than just spreading gossip around, where something like, you know, it's not a social network. There's no secondary potential for it other than just being sort of titillating briefly. And plus, you know, it's so hard for me to keep up with Paris Hilton and Lindsay Lohan that I have no time for this.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting. I guess if we were to make this part of a trend, which is always dangerous to do, but, it's coming along at the same time that WikiLeaks.org has gotten a lot of press of, again, a kind of open, anonymous play wiki like this. I guess this is more, now that I'm looking at it, it took forever to load, Tom, you're totally right. But this seems more like a message board. WikiLeaks is a place, for instance, that people have posted, you know, Scientology papers and some of those bank statements that got WikiLeaks in trouble a few weeks ago. All kinds of stuff that's posted there. It's purporting to be sort of under a kind of a First Amendment airing of the dirty laundry from the corporate world or political world sort of thing. This is obviously a little bit more pernicious and I think quite directly so. It seems hard to see how this doesn't have significant problems. All right, but Mills, you brought up the social networking part. I mean, hasn't this been sort of going on just behind the scenes on Facebook in a kind of closed sort of way?
I would guess. I mean, gossip has been popular since there has been print. So this is just digital print. And so, I think it's just kind of a gossipy thing. And I think people will be titillated by it because they'll go and look at it and say, oh, my God, I can't believe somebody actually did that. But I also think certain students will cross the line and they'll find that their anonymity online is not what they think that it is. They just because they are able to post things quote unquote anonymously does not mean that a search warrant won't track back to them. And so if they post something that is threatening to someone else or could lead to physical harm to someone else, they're going to find a police officer showing up at their door one day with a warrant. So,
That happened. I think there was just this week a student was arrested based on something he had posted on I can't remember which campus he was on, but arrested based on something he had posted at Juicy Campus, something threatening. So,
And they were found by IP address or something like that.
I assume so. There wasn't much information in the story I read, but
Unless people are using high-end encryption techniques and routing their messages through various anonymous hacker servers, they're awfully easy to track back.
Right. Well, I guess we'll keep tracking this site, but it certainly has gotten a lot of free press, including, alas, on our podcast. We'll continue on the legal news roundup here. speaking of, there a student expelled for participating in a Facebook study group. I actually had a post on my blog a few months ago saying that study groups might be a good way to use Facebook. Mills, you were tracking this story for us. What happened here, and why was this student expelled?
Well, he read your blog. He thought, wow, what a great idea. I'll do it. And now I got kicked out of school, so my lawyers are going to be calling you soon.
Right. Shouldn't have given my web address at the start of this podcast.
Yeah. The case here, he was a freshman computer science student at the University of Toronto, and he created online study groups through Facebook for students in the class that they were taking. And so did essentially, as far as I can tell, did essentially what you were proposing in your blog post. And the university decided that this was aiding and abetting cheating and plagiarism and kicked him out. He subsequently had a hearing with an academic panel, a faculty panel. And the most recent news, he came out of that meeting with his family saying, I'm confident that went well, and I think things are all going to work out. So we'll see. But from my perspective, what's more interesting as a sort of a bigger picture is here you have sort of two cultures clashing. Faculty members constantly encourage students to form study groups. It's one of the best things you can do for your students, especially in a really hard class, is to get them together working collaboratively to try to figure out difficult material. That sort of thing is encouraged. Plagiarism and cheating, obviously, are not. And so here a student comes along and takes something that we in the academy have been encouraging for a very long time, which is the creation of study groups, and says, ah, here's a perfect platform for doing this. And so they form study groups, and he was the one who facilitated all of this. And suddenly he's culpable somehow. I mean, I don't know all of the details, so I can't pronounce whether he was guilty or innocent on this. But it's a case of, I think, a younger generation of students taking the platform, which they're very confident with and very comfortable with, and using it to do something that we want them to do, which is work collaboratively. And so the university is now trying to figure out how to match their academic standards up with this platform.
Right. I mean, I did cover there is a Facebook application called Study Groups, actually. And it didn't seem to me that it was, really there for copying someone's, problem set or something like that. But it really was to sort of facilitate some kind of dialogue over, you know, work for that week. And, I think its intent was good, but I guess there are ways to use these things that are not so good, although you could always just email someone with the answers to the test or any number of other things.
Or you could go down the hall to the copier and make copies as you know, in the time honored way of our generation, and
right.
And then hand out those copies. Or, you know, in the good old days you could actually hire a transcriptionist to do it for you. But this is just so if in fact he was using Facebook to facilitate cheating, well, that's one thing. If he was using Facebook to create study groups to facilitate collaborative work, well, that's a whole different thing.
Right.
I think it's all about the intent. People can get together in a group, and they can get together in a group for the purpose of cheating, or they can get together in a group for the purpose of learning. And I think, depending on their intent, I think that's what you need to look at when you're litigating or investigating these kinds of things.
Well, it seems to be the intent of Apple to put iPhones in every student's pocket by the fall. And we've been looking here at the first campus actually to announce that they're going to deploy. I guess you have a choice of either the iPhone or the iPod Touch, which of course is the sort of iPod relative of the iPhone. It's got the same interface with those little icons, and it's got the multi-touch interface. So the first university to deploy these is Abilene Christian University, not probably the university you might think would be the first up, but Apple also seems to be talking to Stanford and MIT, Yale and Harvard about joining ACU in being a kind of iPod campus. And this also seems to be related to the launch of the iPhone SDK or Software Developers Kit, that clearly there's going to be educational applications on the iPhone and for the iPod Touch as well that we'll see out by the fall. I guess this is precisely what we were predicting at the end of last year, Tom and Mills, right? That mobile will be big, and this seems to be part of the story. What do you think the potential here is for this? And Mills, does this fulfill your vision of having a device in everyone's pocket on campus that can do all kinds of things based on location and in the classroom as well?
I think it does. I mean, I think it creates the possibility of faculty members designing all sorts of interesting interactive activities where if there's a level playing field, all the students having the same technology access, then you could really do some exciting things. I mean, I already have two or three applications thought up for my history classes for the fall. Unfortunately, Apple isn't volunteering to give my students iPhones, but who knows? Maybe they'll listen to the podcast and call me up. But I've already come up with a couple of really good ways of porting this sort of thing over into a history class. So much of the sort of classroom response technology work that's done right now is more in the sciences and mathematics, where kind of limited response questioning is more available, multiple choice tests, that sort of thing. But I've come up with ways of doing it in the history class too. And so if everybody did have something in the classroom that was the same, that would be great. And it also, of course, allows them to get up out of their desk in the classroom and go wander off across campus or wander around in the community and do some really interesting and creative things. And so I think it's a really exciting development. And I have to say, I'm really pleased that it started with a really resource poor institution rather than Stanford or Harvard or you know, someplace with they can afford to pay for this themselves. Much better that it's starting at a place that really that doesn't have that kind of money to throw around.
That's a great point, Tom. What's your thoughts on this program?
I think it's a I think it's a great program, and I'm happy that Apple has opened up the iPhone SDK. I should say that straight out. I think it is going to be a great platform, and I think we are in for a year or a couple years of some really fantastic experiments. At the same time, I think I should say that there are some problems with the way that Apple has opened up the iPhone to developers. It seems that all of the applications that you're going to be able to download for the iPhone are going to have to be downloaded through the iTunes Music Store,
right?
Which sort of begs the question: does that mean you have to pay for everything? Now, you can get podcasts like ours through the iTunes Music Store, and you don't have to pay for them. The question is Apple going to allow free applications to be downloaded through the Music Store? And that's I don't think, clear.
Yeah, no, I think they are going to allow free applications.
Okay.
I mean, the applications developers will have to pay a fee to become a registered developer, and I think at the low end that fee is $99.
They will
allow for the free applications. I think they do have to go through a vetting process.
Right, right.
They want to make sure that you're not going to run malicious code. The details on the SDK are pretty interesting. And I think in an odd way, Tom, I also was worried about some of the conditions there as well. I mean, you know, it'd be nice to, for instance, give my students an application directly rather than have to upload it to the entire world at on the iTunes Music Store, which I assume will become the iTunes Music and Application Store,
right?
And movies and TV store and whatever else it's morphing into. On the other hand, I think there are some things that commercial developers are annoyed with the SDK that actually might be great for education. And the number one thing that I saw, which was interesting, is that iPhone applications can't run in the background. That is, you have to sort of go into an application. So if you're on if you're on a phone call or something like that, you're leaving that to go into the application. The application runs, and to take a phone call or to text message, you actually have to leave the application completely. And in that way, it may be a way to sort of keep the attention of the students who won't be text messaging. I mean, if you, Mills, for instance, if some of the applications that you've spelled out on your blog and other places of, you know, for instance, the clicker kind of application, that means that in an iPhone or iTouch, iPod Touch application, a student would have to go into, let's say, the History 101 application and kind of stay in there for the class if you have an exercise in that environment where, let's say, they were looking at historic photographs and had to vote on the authenticity of one of those photographs on the specific one that's coming to their phone. They won't be able to so easily quit that application and do other things on the iPod Touch at the same time. So maybe there's a silver lining here in the kind of restrictions that Apple set up.
Well, I think that's something that cuts both ways. On the one hand, as you were describing
right,
that, I was thinking, I'm okay with that because then they can't also be playing solitaire or text messaging their friends or whatever. On the other hand, it means that they may have difficulty then flipping over to the Library of Congress website and doing some quick research to answer
right,
a question.
Exactly.
I just have to see how it's going to play out.
Yeah, and I think the other thing to mention is that the way I understand it is that the phone trumps everything. So that if you get a phone call, the phone rings and it closes your application.
Because it's a phone.
Because it's a phone. And that's what Apple's trying to – I mean, what Apple's trying to do with only allowing you to run really one application at a time is to preserve the user experience, right? They want it to be seamless. They don't want you to have 5 or 6 or 10 or 20 applications open at the same time and crash your phone. They want it to, you know, look and feel and work seamlessly. And the way they're doing that is to say, okay, you can only run one thing at a time. And as I understand it, the phone comes first. And so if students get a phone call during class and they've got their phone out, whatever application you're having them run will quit. And that could be a problem. But as I think, as Mill says, I think we're going to have to see how all this really plays out.
Right. Well, this will definitely be the year of the mobile application, along with that Apple iPhone SDK. There'll be the Android, the Google's effort to colonize the cell phone with applications as well. And we'll be on this for the entirety of 2008. As I said at the beginning of the podcast, this is our first anniversary of the podcast itself, our 23rd podcast. We missed I guess it would be 26 if we had actually done it every other week, as we say in our motto for the podcast, but not bad considering all the vacations and intercessions and spring breaks, so to only miss a few is not too bad. And we wanted to sort of take this first year anniversary podcast as a time to kind of do a little self-assessment, self-criticism, and also to encourage our audience to help us out and think about ways that we can improve the podcast by joining us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you'll be able to comment on some of the things we're going to talk about and make suggestions on this episode. Episode 23. So let's dive right in. I guess, Tom and Mills, first of all, I guess we should discuss how we actually produce this podcast and whether it's adequate or not, something we question every week as Skype treats us well or treats us poorly. I guess that's where we should start, is that we do use Skype exclusively. We tried, I think, on one of our early podcasts when we had Bill Turkle on to do this around a microphone at a table, and actually the sound quality was worse than doing it over the network. You know, whether I'm at home or in my office, we seem to get pretty good sound out of Skype. We all have inexpensive headsets. I mean, the headset I'm using is a Plantronics USB headset that I bought for $40. And I guess the two of you're not using much more expensive mics, is that right?
No, I think I might even be using a cheaper one. I'm using a Logitech, and I think it was, maybe $40, $39.95.
Right. So, Mills, you as well?
Yeah, I have the same one Tom has. Right.
And then we use a $10 program for recording calls in Skype, unsurprisingly named Call Recorder. And that's from Ecamm, E-C-A-M-M. And you can get that program, and it just gives you a little record button. And we found, actually, we looked at a bunch of different technologies for doing this, but we found this to be really a simple way of recording our calls and also adding in other guests, because with Skype, we can do Skype out to a regular telephone and include people that way if they're not used to Skype. Or, as was the case a couple of weeks ago, in the To Read or Not to Read podcast number 21, we actually had our guests join us by Skype as well. So if people are technically literate, it's very easy to add in others. And, we've gone up to a half dozen people with no problem at all or no degradation in Skype. So we record the three different segments, and then we actually then blend in the music, and Ken Albers, our manager and podcast technician, takes the raw audio that we record and masters it in Audacity and sort of lines up all the sound files and adds in the intro music, which was done, the intro and outro music, by our colleague in the history department, Mike O'Malley, who did it all in GarageBand with public domain sound files and some of his own bass lines that he's thrown in.
These are all Mac programs,
right?
Call Recorder and Audacity.
Good point.
Audacity might have a PC version, but we're working almost exclusively on Macs.
That's right. I think Audacity is available on all three platforms, Linux as well.
I think it is.
It's an open source.
Yeah, that makes
open source program.
Makes sense.
So really, this is a very low cost setup. I mean, it's a $100 setup, I guess, for everything all told. And then it just goes out, to publish these things is very easy now. We just have a WordPress blog that we host the site on, and you just attach the sound file to it and write a description, and it goes up to iTunes and to the rest of the universe over regular RSS. So
and we use FeedBurner for the to handle the podcast enclosures, which makes it very easy to not only to handle the podcast enclosure, the enclosure of the audio file, but also to track subscribers and let us know, you know, who's listening and who's having trouble and whatnot.
Right. And I guess, you know, we should talk about our audience size a little bit. I think it's sort of helpful for our audience to know. We now have over 400 subscribers through our FeedBurner subscription rates. We've suspected that the subscription numbers are actually a bit higher simply because people don't have, for instance, iTunes open all the time, so we don't get a ping from everybody every day. It's probably 500, 550, something in that range. And then we have about 1,000 people listen to the podcast overall. So there's another set of audience, people who just, you know, come to the website, maybe sample one podcast or another and are not subscribers, at least at the current time. So we've been very happy with the growth of the audience. But still, I think there's a lot of work that we could be doing. And so we thought we'd just start with maybe some self-criticisms. Maybe, Melissa, if I could talk with you, what do you think we could be doing better? What are we missing out on? And again, we're going to encourage everyone to criticize us this week on digitalcampus.tv and help us out.
Well, I think that the main thing, you know, I was making some notes about this last night, and the thing that I think really makes a good podcast is one that stays on topic. And I think at the beginning of our year last year, we were not very good about that. We tended to wander all over the place. And as the year's gone on, we've gotten a lot better about it. But I think that because we know each other very well, and for us, this is in some ways a conversation that we have in the office when we're not, don't have our headsets on. We tend to wander around a little like we would in a normal conversation. And so the more disciplined podcasters can be about staying on topic, the better, because people download a particular podcast that, you know, those people who aren't subscribers, they download a podcast because they want to hear about that thing that the podcast cut line says it's about. And so then to have people wander off and go talk about something else can be intensely frustrating, and you wonder why you did that. So I think one of the things we have to really remain vigilant about is staying on topic.
I think that's a great point. Probably have gotten a little bit better at that. Tom, what would you say is the sort of thing we need to work on for year number two?
I think probably, you know, I think we could all get a little better in terms of staying on topic. I think we could all get a little better on one thing I know we tend to do is this, it tends to come up really quickly. Every 2 weeks, the podcast sort of sneaks up on me.
Catches us off guard.
Yeah. And I think probably it would probably behoove us to do some more planning in advance. Maybe talk about what stories we're going to cover a couple days ahead of time. And actually, you know, really do some hard thinking on them, and maybe have a conversation amongst ourselves beforehand so we really sort of understand where we're all coming from beforehand. So maybe a little bit more preparation. In terms of the technical
setup, Tom, if I could just interrupt you there for just a second, I guess we should also tell our audience that we've tried various methods of sort of sharing news stories with each other in advance of the podcast.
Yeah.
And I guess we've now settled on using the share feature in Google Reader. Although Mills, I haven't gotten this set up with you, but you can click on a little share for items that look interesting and worthy of discussion in the news roundup, and they'll show up in the other hosts' feeds as well. So that's something we've been using. Anyway, Tom, go ahead. Sorry about that.
Yeah. And then in terms of the kind of technical setup, I do think there's more we could do with the sound. I've noticed occasionally that one thing that kind of bugs me, we're going to see if we can fix it in Audacity, is our podcast seems a little quiet. When I'm listening to it in the car, I have to kind of jack my volume up all the way. And then I get interference, just kind of speaker hiss when I listen to it. So it's maybe quieter than other podcasts I listen to, and so I'd like to fix that. And then I do think that we could maybe, while I think our $100 setup has served us very, very well, I think we could maybe spend some time and investigate some maybe a $200 setup that would give us a little bit richer, fuller sound and give our audience members a maybe more enjoyable listening experience. So there are some things I think we can definitely improve it. And as you said, Dan, I think I'd love to hear from audience members, even nitpicky things that we could do better, because it is important to refine this. We're not professional broadcasters by any means. None of us have a background in radio or anything like that. And so there's tons we can learn. And if anybody has any suggestions, we'd love to hear them.
Yeah, the sound is an interesting question, because I think what we realized early on is that sound quality in a podcast is like design on a website. And there's this sort of unconscious aspect to it where people say, oh, this is something professional. You know, in the first split second when you look at a website, you say, this is professional or this is amateur. And I think the same thing happens with sound. I mean, when you've got feedback, when you've got, lower volume, when you're missing some bass levels in a podcast, the ear picks up on that really quickly and says, oh, this is really amateur-y. And so I think we probably could get better mics. It's what I sort of have trouble thinking about is, you know, would we want to move up to the full studio setup? I know we've got one, a media lab here at George Mason that's got, you know, soundproof booths and things like that. I think the problem is we've wanted this to be a somewhat casual podcast, and that, you know, not scheduling it for an exact time. And also we've generally done it where we're not looking right at each other. We're all in different places. And so
it's like hard today. To,
yeah, exactly. Right. And I've actually, oddly enough, in the podcast where we have been looking at each other, I found it harder than when we're, maybe it's that I'm getting used to this setup, but I actually find it a little bit easier, almost like talking on the phone, when I'm not looking at someone. So, picking up those cues has been something that I think we've really had to learn, the kind of, you know, when is a segment going to end? What's a wrap up, these sorts of things. And, I've certainly struggled with trying to get transitions, down as well.
Well, the other question that comes up is, for me along those lines is, you know, increasingly people are doing video podcasts, and whether we might want to consider that or not. I have to say, I don't watch a lot of video podcasts. I mostly listen, because I'm almost entirely listening in my car or on the bus or something like that. So, for me, I'm not that interested, but I would be really interested to hear what people in our audience have to say about it.
Yeah, the video thing's an interesting thing. I like our colleagues, Dave Lester and Jeremy Boggs, have that podcast, which we've talked about on the podcast before. Now, they do a video podcast, but in their case, there's really a purpose for video. They're doing hands-on tutorials of different web applications and other things. And so they're actually showing you something. They're moving around the screen with a cursor and doing work on the screen that needs to be seen, not heard. I don't know what my, you know, face, my ugly mug would add to our discussion, but maybe it would, and maybe people want to see that, and I think, you know, we'd be open to trying if people do.
Well, for instance, I don't know if either of you have seen the website bloggingheads.com, but they get two bloggers who are then talking about a particular issue of the day that's come up in their blogs, and it's just done with, you know, whatever the webcam in their computer is, but you actually see the two people talking to each other, having their conversation, and so it can be a little more engaging as a result, but doesn't do me any good when I'm driving.
Right, that's right. Well, we could indeed have a video, and which I think we could record out of Skype, as well as the sound files, and we could have people subscribe to either one. So we're going to ask again our audience to weigh in on this question: do you actually want to see us, or can you get enough enough of the podcast just from the audio?
Would you really rather not?
Right, exactly. So what are some of the things that we've done right? What do you think are some lessons that we've learned over the past year that we are getting right now? Now that we've criticized ourselves, what can we do to kind of help out our audience? People who are thinking about doing podcasts. Mills, maybe could I start with you again?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that we've done right this year is that we really have tried to have a diverse base of things to talk about. You know, we've tried not to just talk about the same issues over and over again. We have some recurring things that we come back to, but we really have tried to think through having a kind of a list of for our main feature segment, have you know, a list of different things from podcast to podcast, so that we are, you know, sometimes it's about what's happening in digital humanities, sometimes it's about what's happening in the classroom, sometimes it's what's happening with new technologies. You know, we've tried to mix it up that way, and some podcasts I end up unsubscribing from, it's because they just beat the same horse over and over.
Right.
Yeah, so, I think one thing that we did right was, and I don't think we thought this out, but it turned out to be a good decision, is the format of the podcast. I think we have kind of a diverse format with the news roundup, then 20 minutes or so of the feature story, and then some picks of the week. I think that kind of breaks up the podcast and makes it seem a little, you know, it's still an hour, but it doesn't, maybe goes by a little faster because there's some diversity there. So I think that was probably a good decision. Makes it easier, I think, for us as well. It kind of gives some pace and timing to the podcast. So that was a good decision.
It'd be great to hear from our audience on that as well, and also about just the length in general. So, you know, we generally end up around 50 minutes. Is that too long? Too short? Do people want to hear more news? Fewer news items? Be good to know. But I agree with that, Tom, about the segment.
Yeah, the other thing I guess I would like to hear from audience members, I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing, really, is the introduction of guests. I think over the past six or so episodes, we've been having more and more guests on, and that's been fun for us. And I think we've had some great guests, and I think we can continue to bring on guests. I know we've had various requests from people to appear on the show, and we'd be happy to oblige if that's what our audience wants. What I don't know is whether people like to hear just us. Maybe it's, you know, comforting or something just to come back and tune in and hear Tom Mills and Dan. Or maybe the introduction of guests is a good thing. But we don't want to overdo the number of guests either. So what is the proper balance between having guests for the feature segment and just having the three of us? That's something I'd really like to know.
Yeah, that's a great question to ask our audience. And, you know, from our end, it is a little bit difficult when we have guests just in terms of the setup. The three of us now can all get on Skype and within 5 or 10 minutes we have to level up our sound so that we're, you know, not one person's too loud and no one's too weak, and we try to get that all set up. But we now have that down to a science. When we add in other people, it gets very tricky as we try to figure out what the sound levels could be. I wonder also if, from, you know, to ask our audience, are there topics that we've missed? I think one thing that I'm feeling, you know, that we're maybe not getting is enough feedback, I guess, from our audience in general. I thought we would be getting, you know, more responses. And I wonder if this is just a podcast thing, that when you read a blog post, you're right there, you can add a comment in. But a podcast, you know, you're listening to it in the car or while jogging or in some other place, and you sort of have to remember to go to the website and comment. I'm sort of interested, or is it just not something that people want to comment on? I can never get a sense of why that is. I mean, I've had blog posts that have had, you know, 30 or 40 responses, and we've really only had maybe up to 5 or 6 responses on a maximum on our podcasts. So I'm wondering if, you know, our audience would like more interactive features. I mean, should we have, you know, easier ways for people to get in touch with us? Would people like to see our news feed as it's developing? So, you know, would they like to tune in to see what we're sharing with each other and thinking about for the next podcast? These are all kind of mystery questions for me, as well. Let's see. So I guess we're gonna ask for everyone's help this week, and we do hope that we get 30 or 40 or 50 responses on this. And I guess we all want to say thanks again for tuning in. We're looking forward to another year here at the podcast. And as always, you can reach us at digitalcampus.tv and also at feedback@digitalcampus.tv, which Mills and Tom, I've noticed actually recently activity on our email address is actually picked up. So maybe that ends up being the kind of easiest way to get in touch with us as well. But through any of those venues as well, get in touch with us, and we will respond to your feedback starting on Digital Campus 24 next week. It's time for Picks of the Week, which also, I guess, could use some commentary, whether people like our picks or not, or if we're missing some area that we're not picking in. Tom, what do you have for this episode?
I've actually got a post that one of our colleagues, Jeremy Boggs, wrote recently. We talked a little bit about the setup that we use for the podcast, and I think something else, budding digital humanists, digital historians, people who are just getting started with web design and web development would be interested in is the setup that Jeremy uses to create websites at CHNM. He's our creative lead and our head web developer. And he has a great post recently. It was from the 2nd of March. It has a long URL, so we'll just put it in the show notes. His blog is clioweb.org, so you can find it there. But he has a great post called Design and Development Setup, where he just runs through really his whole toolkit, the software that he uses, the various browsers that he has installed for testing on his machine, the hardware that he uses, the monitor setup, all of those things that he uses to build the tremendously beautiful and great websites that he builds. It's really just a great place to start if you're interested in technology, but aren't actually building the web software and websites yourself. Start with Jeremy's post, and he'll give you some good tips on the kinds of things you need on your machine and on your desktop to do it. So it's at clioweb.org, and the post is called Design and Development Setup. We'll put the full URL in the show notes.
It's a great post. Thanks for the link, Tom. Mills, what do you have for us?
Mine is actually a more, in some ways, more traditional academic site this time. It's the online journal First Monday. I don't know if you guys ever read this one or not, but
sure,
So the March 3rd edition of First Monday, so it's volume 13, number 3, is actually a special issue on Web 2.0, and it's some. I started reading the articles over the weekend, and there's very good stuff in there. My favorite so far is one by Anders Albrecht. Called Online Social Networking as Participatory Surveillance. So very thought-provoking, and there are a number of really – it's a very critical appraisal of Web 2.0 and what it means both for academics and for society as a whole.
Yeah, it's a great great issue. I've made my way partway through it, but it's definitely worth a look, and I think a good critical eye on what's going on right now. Well, for this week, I've got – A site that I think is really helpful for a task we often have at the center, which is sort of critiquing websites and trying to fine-tune them. And we're often distributed. We have, someone might be at home, someone might be in the office. We might have a developer in a third location, web designer in a fourth location. And there's a new site called Twiddla, twiddla.com, T-W-I-D-D-L-A.com. That allows you to load a web page into a kind of common space that you can share with others, and then gives you a kind of ability to draw shapes on it, to write text in, to put boxes around things. So if you get on the phone and then all join in one of these little forums, you can then really easily critique the web design of a site and look at it really carefully. I think it also might be useful for classrooms as well, now that I think about it. But it just got launched. They're really in kind of a beta period. But it's something that you might want to try out if you are at all involved with web design and kind of need to tweak it and have people all over the place working on that website. Again, that's at twiddla.com. So, Tom and Mills, congratulations again. Looking forward to another year on the podcast. I have to say, I mean, it's been a lot of fun. I have to say that sometimes I feel like my blog is work, my other writing, my publication writing is work, but doing the podcast, it is a great deal of fun. And I hope it's been useful for our audience, and we want to thank as a group, and hope to see all of you again in 2 weeks on our first edition of the new year of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself.
please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music. Ask not.